Thank you all for coming here tonight. This is a program we've been looking forward to for a long time. What a night we have tonight. We've been talking a lot at the Writer Center about how to open up Charles Olson and how to let more people in to what Charles Olson is. And for a lot of us, that's ripe. There's a lot about Charles Olson. And we thought getting three women together, getting their work together, would be a good lens to work through. And as it is, it turns out we have three different views of Olson from three different women because we don't all think alike. I know, it's shocking. And I'm very happy to have Kate Colby here and Kate Tarla Morgan and myself. I'm excited to share my own work. So I think we should probably get started because we have a lot to hear tonight. I'm going to introduce first Kate Colby. Kate Colby is the author of 7 books of poetry, including The Arrangements. A book of literary essays, Dream of the Trenches, is forthcoming. Fruitlands won the Norma Farber First Book Award from the Poetry Society of America in 2007. She has received awards and fellowships from the Rhode Island State Council for the Arts, the Dodd Research Center at the University of Connecticut, and Harvard University's Woodbury Poetry Room, where she was the 2018 Creative Fellow. She lives in Providence, Rhode Island. Kate Colby.
Thanks, everyone, for coming out on this very suddenly cold autumnal evening. And thank you, Amanda, for organizing this event, and to Kate for joining us, to the Gloucester Writer Center, the Rocky Neck Cultural Center, and to the Maud Olson Library, where I completed work on this essay last summer. This work most of it was completed at Harvard, where I had the fellowship last year. And that work resulted in an essay. And I cut it down a bit for this evening. It was a little long. And I carefully excised it from the middle. And I'm hoping I did it so cleverly you won't even know. It's called The Bind. Gertrude Stein said, "And then there is using everything." I have long held to this aspirational strategy, taking completion as a basic measure of the world as I would have it, and wanting to depict it at total scale. I long to pull all that is, was, and might one day be into concentric shapes around me. Recently, in the course of doing research on the poet Charles Olson, about whom I'm supposed to be writing per a fellowship proposal, I decided to write about Leonardo's Vitruvian Man, whose intra-referential proportions are meant to extend to everything, perfect man as basic measure of the universe. I thought I might also write about Vesuvian Man, the heat-blasted, ash-buried bodies left at Pompeii, mostly for the wordplay. But I do have a knack for making things mean, and there's something concentric about a spread-eagled man representing the proportionality of the universe and the bodies curled up under a deadly blanket of ash, although I'm not sure which shape contains the other. Everything might already be here in some form or another, but you can't have it all. Per the uncertainty principles say, you can know a moving object's speed or position, but not both at once. I mean to toggle between. Charles Olson tried to include everything, with the exception of women. But on this livid March morning, raw cough, wet snow patches on ugly asphalt roofs, I am thinking about excision as another way toward completion. Not whiteout, but vantablack, the blackest black material, which absorbs 99.965% of light. If you shine a flashlight on it, the beam disappears. It betrays no contours or third dimension of whatever it's applied to. If I wore a dress of it, for instance, my head and hands would appear to jut from a 2D dress-shaped void. I would find this garment more useful than an invisibility cloak, I think, to to look down at my blacked-out torso and lap and know a more palpable absence. Lumped into my preoccupation with scale is equivalence. I just learned that the kilogram is a physical object stored under two bell jars and whose mass has been changing over time. Thus, since the late 18th century, a good deal of the human world's physical reality has rested on a basic unit of measurement that's unstable. A team of scientists has just created a stable version, made of a silicon isotope, and the new definition of a kilogram might soon be the number of atoms contained in its reflective, nearly perfect sphere. If the softball-size object were scaled up to the size of the Earth, its greatest deviation from sea level would be 2.4 meters, making it the roundest man-made object. Sea level is a measure of roundness. There's a sample of Vanta Black at the Forbes Pigment Collection in the Harvard Art Museums. Harvard is where I go to not write about Charles Olson. The small patch of it on a crinkled aluminum sheet looks like the space where a slice has been taken from the perceptible world. It looks like the sensation of there being nothing to see. Vanta Black is made from vertical carbon nanotubes, like a fine velvet pile of filaments, each with the thickness of one atom. It even looks velvety, which is strange since velvet looks the way it does because of its sheen. In spite of its inclusion in the Forbes collection, Vanta Black is not a pigment and isn't even black. It's a nearly complete absence of color, which we perceive as black, like a black hole, which no one's ever seen and can't be seen, but which isn't black either. Either is the opposite of seeing, i.e. not seeing, but with eyes. In thinking about Charles Olson, I realized that one thing that drew me to his work in the first place was my sense that he too was trying to render infinity and abstraction in language, albeit by being exhaustive, while lately I've been going at it with a scalpel. Here's the niggling thing about pigment. It might be a basic unit of color, but color isn't in it. Color doesn't belong to a thing. It's an effect of how light is reflected back into our eyes. So the difference between Viridian and Vanta Black is complete, but only due to the fact and/or presence of a seeing body. Maybe humans are here to perceive. Noun or verb, what's the fullest form of being? Wittgenstein, grounds for doubt are lacking. Emphasis mine, his was on doubt. In any case, I have no use for the void, only for its depiction. The artist Anish Kapoor, best known for his reflective bean-shaped cloud gate, holds exclusive rights to Vanta Black in artistic applications. This has inspired much ire in the art world, but I think it's a blessing. How many times can you apply a material evoking the void to an object and have it mean something? Certainly not many, so it's better to keep it unattainable, leaving everyone to slaver over all the things they'd love to apply it to. Thinking about it is much more interesting than seeing a field of Vanta Black headstones, or Vanta Black stained glass windows, or Vanta Black eyeglasses, or swimming pool, or gazing ball, or phone screen, or skylight, or rearview mirror, or bunch of overripe bananas, or whatnot. No matter what you applied it to, a Vanta Black coating would suggest death, futility, and infinity. And while I'm interested in the infinite ways of saying those things, how often do I care to see them? Keith Waldrop, The Eyes Have No Memory. Charles Olson, How by form to get the content instant. I can't know the void, and so this Vanta Black mask / how I want my form torn from me. At the Forbes, there's a pigment made from ground-up Egyptian mummies. Learning of its origins, one pre-Raphaelite buried his tube of it in the yard. I only learned recently that the bodies at Pompeii are actually plaster casts of the hollows the decomposed corpses left in the ash that buried them. I thought the bodies had been preserved under there, like famous prehistoric remains in ice, but no. They are their own shapes of their terror-stricken forms. And this is how I think of Charles Olson. He tried to draw everything there is in around him like mythopoetic ash that revealed his anticipatory death mask. He made a space the negative shape of himself. You can now have diamonds made of your loved one's ashes, and I think that's where I'd like to spend eternity, a lapidary singularity. Vanta black potholes, portholes, a light bulb, a urinal, stars on the ceiling of Grand Central, a shroud, cash, subway rat, ash diamond, or therapy couch. The White House. In response to Kapoor's hogging of Vanta Black, the artist Stuart Semple created the fluorescent Stuart Semple Pink, for which he is now best known, and which is forbidden to Anish Kapoor. To purchase the pigment on Semple's website, you must first agree with the following statement. By adding this product to your cart, you confirm that you are not Anish Kapoor. You are in no way affiliated to Anish Kapoor. You are not purchasing this item on behalf of Anish Kapoor or an associate of Anish Kapoor. To the best of your knowledge, information, and belief, this paint will not make its way into the hands of Anish Kapoor. Hashtag share the black. This game of proprietary color harkens back to International Klein Blue, patented in 1960 by Yves Klein, best known for his attempts to render the void in it. Klein's blue is a run-of-the-mill ultramarine, but the binding medium is a matte synthetic resin with a textured materiality, reportedly resulting in a vertiginous depthlessness when the paint is apprehended in person, something like a cloudless sky on a low humidity day. It seems that the essence of a color can belong to either the pigment or the medium. Is his exclusive blue more form or content of Yves Klein's paintings? One wants a thing pure, mostly just to own it. Synthetic diamonds are chemically identical to natural, and both are the opposite of Vanta Black. All are made of pure carbon, but a diamond gives the light back. There are countless books and theories pertaining to color, but I'm not interested in pure as in exhaustive knowledge, which might be the opposite of truth. I was planning to paint pigment as the smallest unit or measure of a painting, the most basic pictorial tool, but that is a conceit. The point and the line and other geometric considerations are just as basic, if not more so, in that they are imaginary, conceptual, or theoretical. Geometry is the shape and essence of the universe, and yet perhaps not in it. Vitruvian Man and Vesuvian Man have exactly everything and nothing to do with one another. Their most basic relation is either man's recapitulation of the universe or the precepts of Italian. Color falls into the explanatory gap, or the category of what are known in philosophy as qualia, subjective experiences that can't be explained by physics and physiology. Seeing the color red, for instance, comes down to the dynamics of light and the mechanics of the eye. But the sensation of seeing red cannot be induced in a Platonic cave dweller or computer. And I think this is where Charles Olson was at odds with himself. The point of poetry, to a large degree, if not entirely, is to write into the gap, and he did that, but I get the sense that he thought he could bridge it by filling it in. His collective words read to me like shoveling dirt into his own grave, not to complete it, but to eradicate it. Using the city of Gloucester metonymically, Olson tried to hold in the whole world with the binding medium of his embodied mind. Quote, any of us, the center of a circle, our fingers and our toes describe. At the same time, he wanted to make his mind manifest. Sometimes he called the manifestation breath. Vitruvian Man is named for the Roman architect Vitruvius, whose ideas about the proportionality of the human body it illustrates, with an ideal man in an ideal stance, to all appearances ideally contained by both a circle and a square. Such seemingly perfect geometry seems to extend concentrically to the universe's edges. But circles and squares have no inherent relationship, as the ancient and insoluble squaring the circle problem shows. You can't use a ruler and compass to create a square with the same area as a given circle. There's no equation. As with fundamentals of the quantum and cosmic, these most basic units of reading the world are incompatible. Da Vinci's square and circle and the man pushing back at them are not proportionate. He fudged it. Phenomena is a word for everything between us and the world, including the word. By word, I mean both language and the word phenomena. When the word for a problem is the word for the problem, saying is a way of seeing without eyes. Since I read it in French my junior year of college and double didn't understand it, I've been carrying around a space containing something I didn't yet know how to say about Jory Carl Wiesmann's high decadent classic A Rebours. The protagonist, Des Essentes, holes up and tries to boil his world down to the purely aesthetic. It's totally demented, and now I get it, even if I can't condone it, even if I'm trying to do it. In chapter 4, he has the shell of a living tortoise gilded and set with gemstones in order to offset the colors of his carpet. There's a long passage explaining his choice of stones for each part of the design on the animal's shell. The choices determined by the stones' colors and effects, as well as their obscurity and relative unattainability. The amethyst, while beautiful, is ruled out because the stone, quote, has been debased on the blood-red earlobes and tubulous fingers of butchers' wives who seek to adorn themselves for a modest outlay with genuine weighty jewels. After opening a window and receiving a chill, followed by a graphic memory of a tooth extraction, he notices that the tortoise has died, unable to bear its weighty burden of beauty. If I could hold myself up thus, it would be with a bad photo of a dress that consumed the internet for a few weeks in 2015. Some saw it as white and gold, others as blue and black. It seems the discrepancy has to do with the photo's lack of visual cues as to the time of day and whether the dress is lit by natural or artificial light. Our brains color correct what we see in different lighting conditions in order to read the world as stable. If you see the dress as naturally lit, then it appears to be in shadow and reads as white and gold. If you understand the light as artificial, the photo seems washed out and the colors read blue and black. What bothers me isn't the variable appearance of the dress, nor the question of its actual color, but that the color I see is or isn't actually in or on my computer screen. I don't know how color is digitally rendered, but it's in there somewhere. Just as if I were to print the photo, a printer would have to choose its pigments. Would it use blue and black or white and gold ink? What is the difference between the apparent and the seen? By apparent, I mean seeable, not seeming, although I'm not sure of that difference either. What one concerns what a thing gives off and the other how it's received, neither essential to the thing itself. If there's a difference between wanting to know and wanting to own, what is it? Which is as close as we can get to it. Des Essentes, quote, had long been an expert at distinguishing between genuine and deceptive shades of color. Given his consistent stated object of substituting simulacra for reality, his dining room contains a porthole looking in on fake fish, for instance. I'm not sure of the genuine and deceptive which he considers the lesser. Further complicating either the matter or my understanding of it, he prefers color that, quote, increased in intensity by lamplight, Little did he care if they appeared insipid or harsh by daylight. Studies found a correlation between how self-identified morning people and night owls viewed the shifty colored dress, and it seems Day's ascent would fall into the blue and black camp. He trusts both his senses and his sensibilities, even though they are symbiotically suspect. He shuts himself into a self-made cave of the world, free of context, where things only have the value he accords them, but which he believes is innate. Similarly and conversely, Olson tried to engage and appraise the entire interreferential world completely, but was effete. Both were would-be Vitruvian men, seeing themselves at the center of that which is universal, essential, and scalable to their self-experience. Appearances are all that is real. Creation is the act of creating as well as what's been created. Vanta black compass rose tortoise shell painted inside different kinds of lids, a periscope. I have a particular terror of being buried alive, particularly at the bottom of the sea. In 2000, after an explosion during a naval training exercise, 23 Russian sailors were stranded far beneath the ocean surface in the Kursk submarine. In the days that followed, there were reports that audio equipment had picked up tapping sounds from the vessel's interior. They were later discredited, but it's still not known how long the sailors lived before they likely suffocated. I remember my horror at this news of communication from the soon-to-be tomb of a metal tube. Is it worse to be locked out of or into the world, and how can you tell when you're which? Perhaps it's a word problem. Some science upholds that language developed as a tool of communication, and other science believes it developed to enable thought. This is a complete difference. Brainstem damage from stroke or injury can result in a condition known as locked-in syndrome, where a person is completely paralyzed, except in some cases for the eyes. This sounds like pure hell, being buried alive in a shallow grave of one's own body. But developments in communication with locked-in people have revealed that, by and large, they value their lives and are content even. After being locked in by a stroke in 1995, the French writer and editor Jean-Dominique Bauby laboriously dictated his memoir, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, by blinking his left eye. A diving bell is a pressurized metal chamber used to lower divers deep beneath the ocean, and Bauby likened his locked-in experience to being and hearing oneself breathe in a metal diving helmet at the bottom of the sea. Which is more important to me, irreducibility or utter relativity? Utter meaning speak and complete. If the earth were scaled down to the size of a softball, would we perceive the imperfections of Everest? I am a slight woman. My compressed remains might fit a missing digit. Vanta black cave painting of a cave, pointillist painting in empty gold frame. Even if you could have it all, full-scale, complete content, you can't have it both ways, speed or position, white and gold or blue and black, invisibility or Vanta black. Gertrude Stein said, act so there is no use in a center. But sue me, I love a center, even a fake or synthetic one, and the unknown degree to which those things are opposites or isotopes or both, and especially when the unknown of the center is the center, which is the case herein, where I am only / just writing about Charles Olson. Form is what we want the world with. When I undertook writing about Charles Olson, I proposed to examine the gendered underpinnings of his ideas about proprioception, which he used as a conceptual framework for the wide-angled, intricately counterbalanced writing he espoused. Neither a sense or a faculty nor a faculty, proprioception is, quote, one's ownception, an innate sense of the body part's relative location and motion, the body's perceptual binding medium. Olson outlined and enacted attention-based poetics, positioning the body as scale model of the world as he would have it, dynamic and teetering, tipping and correcting like a dancer, pushing out and against the circle. Olson scholar Irene Nieland proposes pointillist painting as both analog and demonstration of proprioceptive gestalt, where tiny dots of pure color are blended by the eye to produce colors and effects that are not actually on the canvas, a phenomenon which is either not at all like or not unlike a badly lit photo of a dress. You can't misperceive a color. The color of a thing is how you see it. Proprioception is the body's certainty of its own speed and position. There's something in a juxtapositional sensibility that's a wrench in the works of authenticity, a numinousness or quale or form that's torn from me. Seurat began painting a Sunday afternoon on the island of La Grande Jatte in 1884, the same year Huysmans published Au Rebord. How Des Ascens would have hated La Grande Jatte, its additive, non-genuine, irreducible colors representing the world as unknowable with and thanks to a cognitive smearing. The noumenal and our senses in a feedback loop that to an unknown degree excludes the truth, including the degree of the world's stability. To be buried at sea in a hyperbaric chamber of oneself, Jean d'Aubobi, does the cosmos contain keys for opening up my diving bell? There is a recent tradition of referring to the work you're supposed to be writing in and in lieu of the work at hand when the two things by nature turn out to be the same. Both my contribution to and failure to meet the requirements of the genre are both deliberate and accidental. I am, in fact, trying to use everything, even the only and forever former absences and imagined presences, my brain forever circling its square on what by now is a sticky day in July. There's a word for the fear of, but not for being buried alive. I have a sixth sense of not seeing with my eyes. Olson called for a verse in which the poet manages to register both the acquisition of his ear and the pressures of his breath. He wanted not to record, but be made of the world, interior and prior to, outside and in anticipation of, each thing and everything. What would the form of having gotten around and inside of, looking in and out from every angle look like? A perfect sphere, the roundest object, sea level to the core. An isotope is either a complete or the slightest difference between things. Are there different kinds of irreducibility? At the Forbes, there's a ball of yellow pigment made from urine of cows fed mango leaves. There are different kinds of tombs and reasons for being in them. One is made of words. Vanta Black Dancer and Vanta Black Box Theater. I mean to use the limits of the brain, by which I mean both its prison and furthest reaches as a writing constraint, the longest distance between as being, shut up, take this form to fill in slash with. There's an optical illusion called the Fraser spiral, you've seen it, in which a black and white pattern laid under concentric circles makes them appear to coil in. It can be explained away, but the spiral remains, and to that I will hitch my head. Stein, history teaches that history teaches me. History's a habit of thinking. Thank you. Next up is Amanda Cook. Amanda Cook, yeah, I know. Amanda Cook lives in Gloucester with her husband James and children Abigail and Samuel. She sees writing as an integral part of life. She knits, spins yarn, plays fiddle, feeds people, and dances when she pleases. She teaches and works at the Gloucester Writers Center. Her book, which is so good, Ironstone Whirligig, and it's in the back, you should buy it. I keep it next to my bed, was published by Bootstrap Press in 2018. She is currently working on Letter to Maximus, a poem-by-poem reaction to Olson's Maximus poems. Welcome, Amanda.
All right, thank you all. This is going to be different. So growing up in Gloucester, discovering Olson at the ripe age of 19, I've had to deal with him a lot. There's a lot of people who come here to talk about Olson, who come here and tell me about Gloucester through Olson. And I realized that before I did much more, I was going to have to deal with Olson's Gloucester. So what I started was a project where I will read a Maximus poem and write a reaction. Sometimes they'll make sense if you know the poems. Good luck. They also follow the course of the past 2 years, national events and events here in town. So you might know some of those. Letter to Maximus. 1. I am reading your poems. It isn't that I haven't read them before, but I am reading them again, this time with care and attention and all the other words in my eyes. I am trying to make up with you, forgive you, as if you need my forgiveness. I am trying to mark the edges of your shadow so I can see where my Gloucester falls in it. Scholars can stop here. This isn't for you. 2. I am taking liberties. When the poem makes me think of the kitten we buried on 10 Pound Island because there was no land available to us at our first apartment on Mason Court, I will write about it. About how the woman downstairs wouldn't let the pregnant cat in when the storm was howling outside. About how we let her in and she gave birth, and when the storm was over, she went outside and came back with the kitten, soaking wet, too weak to nurse. We warmed it and fed it with a dropper, and it died. 3, by ear. I have listened to men talk about you more than I have listened to your words. I am sitting in Vincent Farini's house, reading Catherine Bayliss's copy of the Maximus poems. I am leaving Butterick in the legal box on the daybed. 4, born. It occurs to me just now that I was born via C-section. I wonder if my grandfather delivered me. I wonder if he delivered Charlie. My own daughter wore your granddaughter's pants to school today. This is the form I take these days. Wash, fold, cook, clean. That too is a form of love. 5, love is not easy. My closest friends growing up moved away. My closest friends now came to this place from somewhere else. That is a lie. There are some from here and some who stayed, but it is not easy. 6, it is raining outside. I don't want to prove myself to you. Poetry is so much a game of one-upsmanship these days, and my list of victories is weak. I can tell you, I have cooked for and cleaned up after some of the best one-upsmen of our day. One night, I left them talking in my kitchen and went squid fishing at the state fish pier. We drank wine and ran from the big dock down to the walkways between the boats and up again. When we got home with a couple pounds of squid, they were still talking. We pulled garlic from the garden and cleaned the squid and cooked it, and we called a Norwegian cab driver to come over, and between the poets and the cab driver and the squid fishers, we each had a few bites to eat. Letter 2. Someone recently said in an argument I was part of that Maximus was a fishing poem, and there didn't need to be any women in a fishing poem. She's never seen the women set up with their novenas or watched them throw confetti at St. Peter out their windows in the fort. Letter 3, Tansy. When I was young, my stepmother would lift me into the trees they had planted in a line in Stagefort Park. I remember so clearly sitting there, feeling invincible and so separate from everything below me. So much tansy. There is something about riding the bus. I took the bus to and from Lanesville so often that the bus drivers still waved to me. One day, Mrs. Muncie took off all her clothes and sat naked on the bus until her stop. This rare thing, this Gloucester, is a choice we make. My children were born in Beverly. They don't deliver babies at Addison Gilbert anymore. On the day I brought my Abigail home, we walked to the top of Governor's Hill and looked out over the city, over the harbor, past the breakwater. I was so sore and tired, but I had no food in the house and didn't know what to do with the family visiting to help, so we walked up the hill with the new baby in the stroller, and we walked down to the hill to Mike's to get subs. You should see the sign at Mike's. We call it Mike's because there are too many S's and the apostrophes are everywhere. I laughed when I saw Summer Sun. My first published poem outside of school was in the Summer Sun. I was a young poet, 19, I think, and you're in it, the poem, I mean. I took projective verse out of the library that summer and read it over and over before returning it to the library. It was a big summer for you, too. They put on quite a show in your honor at City Hall. Pregnant women should avoid tansy. It causes contractions, can bring on labor or abortion. It makes the mouth wet, tansy. Someone wrote years ago about the gentrification of Gloucester because he had seen well-planted flower boxes on the houses in the fort while he was looking for your place. As if the people in the fort don't like flowers too. I should say something here of the islands of men and girls. I hardly know what to say. Song 1. I see so much of myself in these pages. In my book that never came out, insert Corbett Wiener's joke here, I ended, words and pictures, we put them everywhere. When I say I love you, you think I am selling you soap. Song 2. This too, the bodies, sometimes sitting in chairs, eyelids flutter. I am in a cafe now with my own copy of your poems. I should say my husband's copy. The big book full of notes on little pieces of paper. The music here is all wrong. There should be no music. Song 3. Growing up cold, growing up not knowing how or where the other kids got their clothes, happy with the adventure every so often to the Madras shop in Rockport or the flea market in Rowley, growing up on the bus or on foot, growing up never asking, having held my babies close to keep them warm when we were out of oil, and you standing alone, fly gaping. Song 4. I don't know what takes more strength than keeping a home while the men go out and waiting knowing they may not return and waiting praying for fish. Song 5. Apples. Song 6. How can we keep from singing. Letter 5 for Ariane. I had to walk away from this one. I had to walk away. If a poet pisses into the wind, I believe one can be a good writer and a good person at the same time, though some seem less concerned about this than I am. Who are you to say what Gloucester needs? I don't call myself poet any more than I call myself dishwasher or teacher or cleaner or cook, and much less than lover or mother or daughter or friend. I put as much care into a pot of soup as I put into a poem. On Thursday mornings, I work with children turning their words into poems. More often than not, they say, I love mama. Maybe what this island of men and girls needs, maybe what this city has when poets posture and men go out to sea is mothers. Letter 6. I walked away from this for a long time. I come back angry. It's not that I think you are the problem. I can't separate you from the problem. I can't write this unless I am alone. Do you know how hard it is to be alone these days? Years ago, my brother spent his nights sleeping on the deck of an open boat, alone, out at sea, waiting to catch a tuna. One night, he showed up with a block of meat, bloody and red, from just behind the fish's head. The rest he sold at auction. Does he have polis in his eyes? He never had any money to pour back into his boat. He raises his family in a small house looking over the city from the edge of Dogtown. Yesterday, we went to a rally on the grounds of a meeting house on Middle Street. A young girl stood, waiting her turn as old white men walked with determination to the front of the rally and took the microphone before her. Do they have polis in their eyes? Eyes and polis, fishermen and poets. Maud talking to my bosom, if he had looked up, would he have seen polis in my eyes? Letter 7. This carpenter who saw tansy, how could he have been the first to see the tansy take root? Garrett's told me, gently, that I am not so right about tansy. Not wrong, maybe, but not so right. I expect whomever was here watching tansy take root before the carpenter arrived knew how to use it. 1. This carpenter, who made things out of wood and who owned the land of the cut, and Al Gorman, who kept sugar from his sister, and Mason Andrews, are they the cracks, the seams? This commerce, this making and displaying, this keeping sugar from one's sister, this is American savage. 2. I have a photograph of my mother at Whale's Jaw. She is a child. She looks like she, not like she has conquered it, rather like she is visiting an old friend. Her siblings hang from trees around her. Whale's Jaw is broken now, cracked. Some man or other made a fire beneath her, and she split. I heard his name once, the man who broke her. I did not remember it, nor was I surprised. 3. My hands are short, stubby, peasant hands, hands made for work. My mother's hands were small, covered in paint. Before she painted, she worked with cloth. Her hands, too, refused the women's flesh. Tyrian business. I'm not sure how I'm supposed to feel about this poem. I can tell you this. I don't feel good. You say there can be no more names than there are objects, yet I am called many things. Mother, wife, woman, daughter, goddess, slut, vessel. Letter 9. 1. This year, my garden is a mess. My writing is a mess. My art is a mess. Nothing stops for any of it. I have plums on my table, a bowl of tomatoes, a melon, a glass of coriander, seeds heavy on thin stems. An ambulance just passed on Washington Street. The air feels like rain. 2. I could stay at my kitchen table. I will tonight. My friends will come, and our children will scatter to the far corners of the house. Someone might eat a plum, light a candle. We might close the windows as the air cools. But tomorrow I will rise early and stand up against the whiteness in the philfot. Fuck the plum. 3. Starting in Roxbury, watching the architecture change, which bricks they use, which greens, which screens stay torn, which windows hang which flags, the differences of whitenesses, the differences of blacknesses, trying to take up as little space, as little breath. Sometimes you leave the words to someone else. Sometimes it's not your story to tell. 4. There is a buzzing around me, around everything around me. I can feel it in my bones. Above us, the helicopter can't hear our singing. Letter 10. Cod or God, power or power, let us not fool ourselves into thinking either is sacred. 1. At a restaurant downtown, they have a drink called the Saranam Sling. The Cape Ann Museum tore down the Pierce Haskell House without noting its ties to the slave trade. Those great houses lining Middle Street, those captains weren't dealing in fish. 2. There is no 2 in this poem, but in the middle of writing mine, I have folded 3 loads of laundry and peeled a Tootsie Roll off the living room floor. 3. When I leave my city and come back again, I am struck by how different Gloucester is, how separate. There is a danger in idealizing it. Just last week, a drunk stumbled down Roger Street in a shirt marked, Black Lives Don't Matter. 4. Salem's a simulacrum. In that game, the holding out, we have won. We keep our sins neatly swept under the rug and don't offer tours on the hour. Maximus to Gloucester, letter 11, in which I swing from angry to sentimental. That rock, I once looked over and saw my daughter, not yet 10, climbing the face of that great rock. I didn't yell for fear of startling her. I spent my childhood climbing that rock, but the gentler slope and most often the stairs carved out of the back. I have called the DPW to have a bench placed at Stage Fort Park to mark my father's life. He was buried in West Gloucester by the marsh past Bond Hill. My mother won't die, can't die. I could get a bench for her anyway. 1. Tragab Xanda. Our own magic word, our secret history, the street sign all the kids stole, until some man came from out of town and tried to give us our own history wrapped up in song and dance. He used that word as a password, stole it, took the cool right out of it. 2. In which my anger returns. It is a difference in values, I suppose. Those of us that make note of what we feed the sick and dying, that caretaking, is another kind of attention. 3. We cut it close, close, closed, we close off. I have a fierceness in me I let out when someone I love is hurt. I inherited this from my grandmother, who would mutter, "God damn it," under her breath as she walked around the house. You, Captain, can I call you Captain? You have navigated into my waters. Maximus to himself. I have made my life out of the simplest of things, a cup of coffee, a ball of yarn, a simple song sung under my breath. My life is full of ideas, laundry baskets, dirty dishes in the sink, a jar of wilting roses. I can almost imagine you standing, saying your words as I stand, holding a basket of clean clothes against my hip, waiting to be dismissed. This morning, the air was so cold, the harbor so full of sea smoke, it rose around 10 Pound Island, meeting the clouds that hung at the horizon. I drove home knowing there was hot coffee in the pot. The song and dance of. See, that's just what I mean. I would be standing for hours waiting to fold the laundry. Everybody knows tomatoes taste better when you grow them yourself. I am sure some man will tell me I am wrong. Tell me I am doing it wrong. To the left and to the right and to the center, I want to bring all of them flowers. To the president and his winning, I want to throw flowers at him, cover him, bury him in flowers until he is lost in fragrance and thorns. I want there to be something to feel, some life, some love. I want a bowl of oranges, a green glass bowl. But a man has thrown away the green glass bowl and the Orbitron and the rugs with all their patterns and magic, taken them out. These things, this beauty, these bits of magic pose a risk. I want a simple melody played on a piano in one end of a long room while the Orbitron whirs. Maximus to Gloucester, letter 14. I should tell you I don't want to be doing this. I am tired of your sash weights, your man men, and your names. Mostly, I am just tired. The great men are naked. They are losing their crowns. Everything about this, everything, feels like it should be left behind, except for the children. Suck your gums, old man. The children have had enough. Maximus to Gloucester, letter 15. Some sons talk about their fathers. Some sons keep quiet. Sometimes all we are left are stories to reconstruct. 1. It is a gift knowing when to be quiet, when to use your voice. 2. There is broken glass at the base of Tablet Rock. I listen for the children as they climb, no, run up the side. A tree grows from the split in the rock. I used to tell the kids to be careful. I don't bother anymore. 3. I am skipping 3, keeping quiet, as it were. 4. Some of us have worked the whole time. Letter 16. We have more, I hope, than how we make money, more than our things. We are more than we make. One, we can talk about what it means to be to lead, what it means to be a leader. We can talk about money and trusts. We can talk about pedocracies. We would be talking, I think, about men. At least now, when we have dismissed a woman for being too sly and put in her place a fool ready to make America great, how do we find good men? How do we make them? How can we keep good men good? They spoil so quickly. The rocks from Cressy's beach are all over the grass. The man-made wall couldn't hold back the storm. Two, this country, motherfucker, they have pulled the rug from under our feet. Three, hush, we are talking back. Maximus to Gloucester, letter 15, revisited in August. I would be lying if I told you I started this with an open mind. Maybe that's not right. Maybe it was open, but it was set on something in particular, even if I couldn't name it. There are bits of you, of your story, that you had no hand in. I am sure this is true for all of us. There are noises coming from every room in my house. I am going to pour another cup of coffee and make a Manhattan and hope that it helps me continue. One, I haven't written in some time. I haven't. I haven't told you Garrett died. There it is. I don't know why I held this, but I couldn't write more until I told you. Like I can't listen to my messages anymore. I haven't listened since the week after he died. Why bother? What am I going to hear? I don't know that I will ever listen again. Two. Smythe and Standish, Standish and Smythe. I have been rudderless for months. I don't want another navigator. I want a chart, a sextant, a clear sky. I wonder what I want to be. The thing I keep coming to, I want to be quiet. The seas were calm, the wind was fair, that made me so secure. I am leaving time to grieve. I don't want to rush into some harbor. I have nothing in my hold, nothing to sell on shore. I am hollow. My ribs creak and ache with the waves. That beacon above the harbor, that beacon is gone. I have a piece of glass stuck in my foot. There is no tool better for finding broken glass than bare skin. I don't mind. It reminds me that things break. People break. I break. Three, I don't know what to make of it, what comes of it. I have the broom Garrett gave me when we bought our house. When that broom is out of straw, I don't know what I will do. I can't stop sweeping, although the floor looks like I have. I will finish my coffee and my Manhattan, and I will sweep the floor. Four. Oh, poets, you poets. I want to say something about tenderness, about talking to Annie and Hetty and Dale's talk about your letters with Duncan. This may not be the poem for it, but I want to say it now in case I can't find the tenderness later. I am tender now. Sore even. Poets, let yourselves, let each other be tender. Thank you. Boy, that's the best way to end a reading there, with a hug. I'm excited now to hear Kate Tarlow Morgan. Kate Tarlow Morgan, choreographer, author, and teacher, is editor-in-chief of Currents Journal for the Body-Mind Centering Association and editorial consultant for Lost and Found Poetics Document Initiative at CUNY. As sole archivist of the rhythms fundamentals based on the study of human and animal natural movement, Kate teaches in local area schools and studios. Her book of New York City-based essays and stories, Circles and Boundaries, was published in 2012. The Gloucester Writers Center has been a recent home to Kate's dance formation events, including Blue Suit, Fish Glove, the Proprioception Panel, Invisible Stories, an evening with Monsieur Teste, and a Letter from a Friend, all performances inspired by the poets and writers of the 20th century, including Charles Olson. Kate Tarla Morgan.
I'm going to talk about proprioception. So this is a new working of something I've been thinking about for about 10 years. But proprioception, the book by Charles Olson, is something that I've had with me for a longer time. And I'm going to read this and maybe talk in the middle of it. At 21, I was dancing in street and loft performances and working as store manager with Amiel Alkali at Frank Crowley's Used Books in Greenwich Village. I had just graduated from City University during open admissions, where everyone was going back to school at a cost of $30 per year. Adrienne Rich, June Jordan, Audre Lorde, Tony Cade Bambara, and many others taught at CUNY, City College, during this time. Willie, as I called Amiel then, and I attended poetry writing classes with Gilbert Sorrentino at the New School. This was the 70s. Garbage, taxi, rent strikes, blackouts, open prostitution along the Deuce, which was 42nd Street, residential neighborhoods looking like post-war Europe. At the same time, all the doors were open to us. Libraries, parks, pubs, jazz clubs, dance halls, museums, movie theaters, and poetry readings. Robert Duncan would come to our bookstore to hang out after he spoke at the Stuyvesant Church, which is now called the Poetry Project. And we went everywhere and seemingly belonged everywhere. During this time, and that was 1975, Willie gave me a copy of Charles Olson's Proprioception. It was written only 10 years before that. I carried the book around everywhere, and I read it over and over like a manual, and it was for me a manual. So I'm going to talk about proprioception. And I'm going to start with a Maximus poem, Letter 27. I am one with my skin, plus this, that forever the geography which leans in on me. And I'm going to stop there because last night I watched Henry's movie, Police Is This. And in the archival film, Charles is reciting his poems almost as if he's angry, or this one. And he goes, forever the geography leans in on me. And he like, can you do that? It was like his whole, it was substantial, and it was down. In 2010, 35 years later from 1975, I'm still hanging out with Willie, now Amiel. We are at stores doing research for Lost and Found chapbook series, and I came across a 3-page fragment of Charles Olson's written in 1955, 10 years before proprioception. And this, it has no title, and this is what he wrote. The body is a house. Inside the body is a thing as vast and as difficult to experience as the universe, but it has this advantage that it is inside and it can be experienced directly. I want to say that my sole purpose here tonight is to share with you how I understand this and how it is that I think Charles Olson was working very hard to bridge a knowledge that had been lost and at the same time needed to be newly intuited. This is the story of proprioception. Proprioception, which was already defined by Kate very well, means one's own perception, one's own and perception. It's the sense of the relative position of the neighboring parts of the body, right? It is the sense that indicates whether the body is moving with required effort, as well as where the various parts of the body are located in relation to each other. Physically, proprioception is experienced vis-a-vis pressure through the joints, which fires locator messages into the nervous system from joint end fibrous muscle bundles called Golgi bodies. So if you feel comfortable with your neighbor or your friend, if you could take, could I have you as an example? Make sure your hands are warm. You're just going to take your neighbor's hand and their wrist, okay? And you want to just give them a sense, I'm going in, pressuring into this wrist joint. Just that is proprioception. It will trigger proprioception. It's what the baby has to do to push away from the floor. If you are pushing into your joints, you know where you are, which is why in the medical term, they say if the joints are injured, proprioception is injured. So, would you like to try that?
What?
Try it. See how it feels. They just, it happens instantaneously. If you don't want to touch anybody, you could just feel your joints. So we just described the physical reality of proprioception, but I'm going to now talk about the psychic. Psychically, proprioception functions as a built-in technique for consciousness, i.e. an anchor to the self. I know where I am, therefore I am. But as a dancer, Charles Olson, as dancer me, Charles Olson, who also played with Round with Dance, his idea of proprioception is a theory of knowledge that not only includes the body, but begins with it. Here is a quote from a letter he wrote to a dance friend of his named Naharaj. Dance is simultaneously an object and an action. As a medium, it has the tremendous advantage and limit of the human body as an object, and that its action bucks that gravity and can depend on it. The Vedas, who are Indian meditating people, the Vedas define man in two ways, mana as a thing which thinks, and nara as a root, which in its root means to dance. A thing, man, is a thing which simultaneously thinks and dances. So I'm going to back up a little bit, because this is where I think Charles was coming from. In 1794, Johann Christian Ryle, anatomist and psychiatrist of the early 19th century, coined two complementary terms, gemeinfall, general sensibility, and synesthesia, which is defined in Webster's dictionary as the vital sense. Synesthesia, according to Ryle, was one of three that informed the soul. First was external sensation, or the perception of the outside world. Second was the internal sense, otherwise called the organ of the soul, where the abilities of imagination, judgment, and consciousness were housed. The third was this vital sense, otherwise named synesthesia. In the second half of the 19th century, evolutionists incorporated Ryle's third principle, synesthesia, by calling it the primary body sense. In spite of the classic dichotomies of external and internal perception, or the body-mind split, it was still maintained, in addition to sensations of placement and orientation, that mental life was also determined by sensory activity. As the blurring between self-perception and internal sensing continued, Theodore Ribot wrote in his Diseases of Personality in 1891 that personality varied as organic physical sensations varied. Therefore, the unity of the ego was dependent on both consciousness and physiology. The unconscious, as it was then perceived, continued to find its origin in the life of the body. Do you see where I'm going with this? Is that there was a way in which, and we're going to get there in a minute, but there was a way in which you couldn't separate mental thought, psychic thought, and the soul with the body. And it kept going around and around. It kept perpetuating itself in these ways of being able to, the fragmentation of how the body was seen and experienced was able to include the psyche, is really what I'm trying to tell you about. And then something happened in 1906. Charles Scott Sherrington published a landmark work that introduced a more scientific physical explanation of proprioception. Proprioception was the awareness of movement derived from muscular, tendon, and articular sources. This is what we just did. The research would continue throughout the 20th century, bringing us to Webster's dictionaries, the neurological definition that Webster had. So this further sophistication in neurophysiology, as they call it, created a mystery as to where this combination of the vital sense was housed. Where did it go? Where did the senses go? Where did the soul go? Where did the psyche, where did the unconscious go? Well, consciousness. But then we've got Freud, and he's the one that I'm writing Maximus letters to. Freud created this paradigmatic shift by bringing in the theory of the unconscious that halted the investigation of body location as it related to personality. These new ideas negated that the body would be a direct source or place of psychic suffering, rather than the total body being a whole house. The body is a house. The house became a head relegated to the mind's world of symbols. I am not saying that this is not important, because Freud was very important, but what I am saying is that the holistic interdisciplinary function of the vital sense, the senesthesia, was about to be lost. And it was for a while, as a kind of reductive movement system approach ran in tandem to psychoanalysis. Now, I'm aware that it's the end of the evening, so I want to just skip over this fat paragraph and explain to you that after Freud, what happened was there was a whole 60 years of scholars and thinkers who actually returned to the body to study the body. Wilhelm Reich, Ferenczi, Alexander Lowen, Judith Kestenberg, and what they did was they were trying to see psychology in the body. But they looked at it as if it were a way, like if you stand like this, then you're repressed, and if you stand like this, then you're a sex maniac, and so that they made these sort of reductive signages of the body that then would be applied. This is not what they were doing in the 18th century. I'm working my way to Olson. Are you with me?
Yes, sir.
It's complicated. So I'm going to jump to get to Olson by way of my teacher. So back to the 70s, in 1973, my teacher, Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen, was given the name of her work by her teacher in Japan. He told her to call it body-mind centering. And she said, that's really corny, but she kept it. She came up with a response to the significance of proprioception by introducing a deeper knowledge of the body, by training one's awareness vis-a-vis body exploration. Something about what we just did. This was serious inquiry that sought to capture the humanistic, if not philosophical, impulse towards sensory life, the desire for growth, the placement of self, and the drive to connect. Bainbridge Cohen was interested in creating a pedagogy of the real body that demanded an interdisciplinary approach to body-mind. Now we call it somatics, or the study of the living body, and it's deeply experiential. But all of this was already in the air in the 50s with Olson's projective verse, which focused on certain laws and possibilities of the breath and the lungs and ribs and the body. Olson's composition by field opposed traditional poetic methods by seeking the challenge of the transferring what he called of poetic energy to the poem itself and back to the reader. He talked about, we all know this, the kinetics of the thing. So I made a puzzle for myself, and I took some of Olson's projective verse text, where he goes, a poem is energy, and I said, a dance is energy. And then he said, from the moment the poet ventures into field composition, puts himself in the open field. And I say, from the moment the dancer ventures into the field of composition, puts her in the space. Okay? We haven't yet talked about space, so we're working our way back to proprioception. We haven't yet talked about space, but space will always bring us back to proprioception, as proprioception can only happen in space. I believe that Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen, my teacher, and Olson, if they had met in the 70s, they would have created a new definition for proprioception by reconnecting it back to the vital sense. And I quote, this is from proprioception, to which proprioception the data of depth sensibility. That's very old-fashioned. And he also says down further in his manual, proprioception manual I've been carrying around all these years, the sensibility within the organism by movement of its own tissues. What propels us is a fundamental desire to move and also a fundamental desire to know. That's the mana and the nara, right? What we think and perceive is tied up with our body's movement sense, sensation, and our body's body feeling, synesthesia, which has all those three things in it. Therefore, the proprioceptive purpose of movement is like psychoanalysis, Freud. It's a hermeneutic. It carries a message along the path of interpretation. To move is to know thyself. It helps to know this, and especially in this time we live in, when we are out of words. So I want to end with a unpublished fragment from 1965, same time as proprioception, so he's thinking about all these things. This is Olson fragment. It's called Place and Names. You can't use words as ideas anymore, that they can be strung as sounds. They are meaning only and actions of their own sort. You can't use words as ideas anymore. They are meaning only and actions of their own sort. Feeling and desires and breath, the cause of the words coming into existence, ahead of them, the nose, bringing them out ahead of its self, and a principle, their own meaning. Now, I was going to ask you all to stand up with your nose, and we could try that at the end. My last sentence, the acquisition of this broad knowing in Olson's and Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen's experiencing the acquisition of this broad knowing in Olson's words and Bainbridge Cohen's experiencing is housed in what the 18th century Dr. Ryle would identify as a synesthetic domain whose mission is to build the house with all its contents and in its place. Thank you.